Hello, I'm Dr. David Johnson, Professor of Medicine and Chief of Gastroenterology at Eastern Virginia Medical School in Norfolk, Virginia. In March 2013, just released, the American College of Gastroenterology published the new updated guidelines as it relates to gastroesophageal reflux disease. Doctors Katz, Gersten, and Vella put together an evidence-based review of very pragmatic recommendations. Now, they used systematic reviews, meta-analyses, and then clinical trial data in putting together a document which came to 54 recommendations. So they used the GRADE system to prioritize the strength of the recommendation and also the weight of the evidence supporting that recommendation. So rather than to have you go through 54 of these with me in short order, I thought I'd give you the top 10 or the Johnson top 10 list and see if this makes some sense to you. All these recommendations that I'm going to make to you all were strong recommendations, so put in bias of my interpretation as well, but the weight of the evidence for these range from strong to moderate to less than strong, but nonetheless, these are all officially strong recommendations. So let's start the clock. Number 10, that GERD really does not require the diagnosis to be established by endoscopy. This makes sense. In the absence of alarm features, that makes intuitive sense, and way too many patients are still referred for endoscopy as it relates to the diagnosis of gastroesophageal reflux disease. It's a clinical diagnosis. Rule number nine, this is one of my pet peeves. H. pylori testing should not be done in patients with GERD. It makes no sense. In fact, if you treat H. pylori in GERD patients, they may actually be less responsive to PPIs. And if you treat H. pylori patients, one of the primary relapse symptoms actually in the absence of prior GERD is GERD. So do not test. We see this a lot in primary care, and it's not recommended certainly by the recommendations from this consensus guidelines. Number eight, weight reduction matters. So size matters, and very strong recommendation, but it wasn't supported as much by the evidence until what we saw in this current issue, in the same issue that these guidelines are published, a very nice cohort study from Norway looking, it's called the Hunt study, and looking at over 100,000 patients in a patient cohort analysis, they were very accurate in diagnosing the likelihood ratios to decrease if you had a body mass index greater than 3.5 reduction, so a BMI reduced by a factor of 3.5 index, you had a less likely chance of reporting GERD symptoms or for use of GERD-related medication. So body mass index makes a difference. In particular, we'll get into that as we talk about Barrett's, and in particular, the patterns of body mass. But I tell my patients this every time. Weight reduction matters. Don't lose 40 by Friday, but de minimis amounts of weight over time may make a significant factor as releases at reducing GERD-related symptoms and improving the response to medication. So now we have evidence, and we certainly have the support of the guidelines. Number seven, the use of transoral fundoplication device does not warrant current clinical data supporting it in clinical practice as an alternative to surgery. Now, because this review looked at data from 1990 to 2011, it did not include the most recent development of this magnetic sphincter device that was reported in the New England Journal in February. So, but the transoral device is something that is, the esophics is something that is out there, and certainly the committee reviewed this and decided the evidence was not there to support that. Number six, the diagnosis of laryngopharyngeal reflux cannot be made solely by laryngoscopic findings. How many of us see our ENT colleagues send us these LPR patients all the time? It's GERD, it's GERD, it's GERD, go see your gastroenterologist. And the findings of erythema, retinoid changes, of edema, cobblestoning, loss of vascular patterns, these are all things that are quite nonspecific. In my practice, I see them a lot for habituation, repetitive throat clearing, cough, a lot of things that have nothing to do with reflux. And even if they had reflux, they once that's controlled, these symptoms should get better once you address the habituation. So LPR, based on the diagnosis only of findings laryngoscopically, is not an accurate diagnosis. And the majority of these patients will not respond to even empiric therapy in the absence of GERD-related symptoms. Number five, surgery for extraesophageal manifestations of reflux disease will not work unless they were PPI responders. So again, well documented that these people had reflux disease. They responded to PPIs. They're much more likely to improve as it relates to the extraesophageal disease response. In particular, again, gets into some of the habituation, other things that we've seen. But this is never viewed as a refractory extraesophageal GERD patient just based on extraesophageal manifestations alone. And again, these clearly need to be well documented. Number four, if you're going to do pH testing, it's okay regardless of on therapy or off therapy. If they're going to have diagnosis of reflux disease, they should be done off therapy. They should be done with any type of pH monitoring device you have. If they're going to be done on therapy, you should do it with pH impedance because then you want to assess some of the non-acidic reflux in correlation with their symptoms. So if you're using it for a diagnosis to send somebody to surgery, we would say we would do it off therapy. If you're going to assess their symptoms and the response to whatever intervention you're making, do it on therapy with impedance. Number three, screening for Barrett's esophagus should not routinely be done in the absence of high-risk epidemiologic evidence to support this. So again, we're talking about Caucasian males with GERD symptoms in their fourth or fifth decade of life. A very recent study published in the same issue in American Journal of Gastroenterology, again in March of 2013 by Joel Rubinstein and his colleagues at the University of Michigan, found actually in looking at a developmental model, they were much more adept at predicting the majority of GERD patients if they used not only the GERD symptoms, but used age by decades, increasing the correlate ratios, smoking, and abdominal obesity. So look at that article as well as you start to synthesize who should be screened for Barrett's. Remember, screening for Barrett's, we suggest, is potentially like screening men for breast cancer. So women for Barrett's should not be done based on only the symptom of GERD. Number two, this gets into an area of really hot topic, infectious disease related to PPIs. The guidelines committee suggested that the evidence for community-acquired pneumonia was there, but only in the short term. An extended duration of exposure had no effect on repetitive pneumonia. So I don't think that's really a hot topic right now. But what is hot topic and what the committee came down on was the C. difficile association. I'm becoming a little more sanguine on this, being it potential, not absolute. It's a strong recommendation, moderate evidence of support. And in fact, they suggest that C. diff should be considered as a factor in patients that are taking PPIs. But I think looking again for covariate risks, hospitalization and antibiotic exposures, et cetera, nonetheless, the C. diff issue is not closed. We can't dismiss it entirely, in particular if you see somebody that's having relapsing C. diff, always, again, look at their medications and maybe this is one that could be withdrawn. And we're down to the top one. Number one is the effect of bone density loss and PPIs. The committee decided, based on the weighted evidence, strong recommendation, moderate support for based on evidence, that PPI use is not contraindicated in patients with bone density loss. Remember, the FDA made a label change on this in PPIs saying that the loss of bone density has been described and the odds ratios for hip fracture, wrist fracture, cervical spine fracture was increased in PPI users. We've reviewed previously with you a number of times of the longitudinal data suggesting that's not the case. And in fact, the committee decided that this was not an issue as it relates to our ongoing use in patients who were defined at potential osteopenia. Now, if they have other risks, you should reevaluate, do they need their PPI? They didn't come down and say that was a factor or not, but again, the pejorative risks in most of these people is stratified based on their entry level to PPI exposure. Family history, steroids, benzodiazepines, women in their fifth and sixth decade, et cetera. Those are things, inactivity, obesity, there are a number of things, smoking, that all play into hip fracture and bone fracture related risks. So the committee came down and suggested this can be used in patients that are with bone density loss. And this is one of the top questions I get when I see my patients with PPIs and needing PPIs. I always have this conversation when I refill their medications and I just say, listen, I've updated you on the literature. Just again, it's dismissive. I tell them, my wife takes a PPI every day. You'll be the second patient to know if there's an issue, but I don't have this as a significant factor. So what I've done for you is given you the top 10. For those in the US, you can reflect on Dave Letterman, but here you've got Johnson, wherever you are. I hope these have been meaningful to you. and that you can apply these practice to your practice. Those that are keenly interested, delve into the 54 recommendations. It's a very well done document, very well evidence-based, and as I said, graded by the evidence. Hopefully this puts in perspective for you and gives you a little bit of data for your next discussion with your patients who are GERD patients relying on PPI therapy. I'm Dr. David Johnson. Thanks again for listening.